So we looked at the possibilities of engaging some of the so-called YBAs and look at the spirit of experimentation that characterized that period. And of course, one of the pieces, if you have seen the exhibition, one of the pieces that represent that period is a vitrine with ephemera from the shop that Tracy Emin and Sarah Lucas created in 1993. The shop was very short-lived. They rented a building that was previously occupied by a doctor's surgery. And for 6 months, they ran this space that was very experimental, where they would make and sell art and also have workshops and interaction with the public. So it was a very public, very open and interactive place where not only people from the art world, but also the neighbors would come and spend time with them, and they would run kind of educational, kind of very informal educational activities, and a lot of drinking, of course, and partying. And the shop was in Bethnal Green Road. Some of you must have been to it, and it would be great to hear from you if you want to ask questions to Tracy and Gregor at the end of their conversation. As the custodian of the shop, Tracy Emin will discuss the project in the context of the presentation of ephemera in the exhibition Pop Life, Art in a Material World, which celebrates artists' public persona as a product and their relationship with commerce and glamour. Gregor Moore, who will be in conversation with Tracy, was very active in the period as a partygoer, mainly, a friend of artists, and somebody who wrote about that generation in his book, Lucky Kunst, The Rise and Fall of YBA, that documents the 90s art scene in London. In 1997, Gregor founded the Lux Gallery in Hoxton Square, which disappeared, but it was very seminal in presenting video art, especially, and audiovisual media in Shoreditch. Between 2001 and 2003, Gregor was appointed the Crownage Curator of Contemporary Art here at Tate Modern, where he worked on numerous film and video acquisitions for the collections. Along with Jessica Morgan, he curated the exhibition Time Zones at Tate Modern, one of the museum's first exhibitions dedicated to video art, as well as a show with a very strange name at Tate Britain, and I will try to say it properly, Inagada da Vida, which presented the work of Damien Hirst, Angus Fairhurst, and Sarah Lucas. So I have nothing else to say. And I really hope that you're not too impatient. Tracy will make it very soon. And as soon as she comes through the door, we'll start the conversation.
My name's Gregor Muir. Really sorry about the wait. Tracy just sent me a text to say that she's in a CAD, which is meaning that I think she'll be here in about 5 minutes, hopefully. I thought we just saw her outside. But anyway, we have to be a little bit more patient. I thought in the meantime, perhaps what we could do is roll the slides that we have here for this evening, which of course technically we're going to do at the point at the start of the interview. But what we have put together is a great many images from the shop, which we're here to talk about tonight. That's a picture of Gary Hume. And the shop used to be at the top of Bethnal Green Road, which is where Sarah and Tracy started this unusual collaboration next to a pizza delivery place, just near a bagel shop, which I'm sure you know this area. But it was technically sort of, it was Bethnal Green Road, but it was technically sort of at the end of Red Church Street, for those people who know the area. I was a writer, I dare say a younger writer then, for Frieze magazine, which had been going a few issues. And I remember going to go and meet them. I had to go and sort of interview them, or at least I felt it was a very exciting project, and it was something that I felt would be useful for the pages of Frieze magazine at that time. And I remember writing the following, which is that it was at 103 Bethnal Green Road, in February of this year. This is from the article. So in February of 1993, artists Sarah Lucas and Tracy Emin took over a 6-month lease on a former doctor's surgery in the East End of London. 103 Bethnal Green Road has since become Lucas and Emin, selling collaborative merchandise to the public. And there's an interview in which my first question to Sarah at this point was, what's your best seller? And Sarah Lucas replies by saying, the Rothko comfort blankets sell quite well. So do the little Rescue Me labels, and our best-selling T-shirt is complete arsehole. All the T-shirts are hand-painted and go up in price every time we sell one. They start off at £12, go up to £15, and then they go up in fivers until they get up to £50. What happens after that, we haven't decided. But Complete Arsehole is now selling at £40. Tracy then says, and then the next expensive one is £35, and that says fucking useless. And that was actually the first words that I remember Tracy saying, and perhaps it was actually some of, in terms of art press, contemporary art press at that time, probably the first time Tracy had ever really come to anyone's attention. It was the case that Sarah Lucas was quite well known in that she had an exhibition at the Saatchi Gallery at the time, which was in Boundary Row in St. John's Wood. And it was an interesting exhibition where Sarah had put together lots of sort of page three tabloid images and some fairly memorable sculptures. And in a way, I think it was partly helped by the fact that Sarah was selling, that they were able to scrape together the money to take on the lease to do the shop. And it's interesting for me to look at some of these images, which I haven't seen for a very, very long time, but would have been around here at this point to see them in action. The shop hours were very, very unpredictable. And for sure at the weekends, I think it was open from 11 at night till on a Saturday, opened at 11 at night and was open till 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon. So it was for sure they would be there at that point, but otherwise it was just a walk-in shop and you had no idea.
God, he's so boring.
That'll be Tracy. Welcome, Tracy. Do you want to get mic'd up?
Complete arsehole. I don't have to be mic'd up for that, do I? Do you remember this, Gregor?
Yes, I was just saying how much I did remember it, yeah.
How young we were.
Indeed. You're right. Tracy, why not grab a seat? No, or just you'll stand in that pose for the whole evening.
Am I mic'd up now?
Yes.
Can I just explain? I have just been working for GQ magazine for the last 10 years. I've gone from hotel reviewer to contributing editor to feng shui editor, and now I'm poet in residence. And I've just left the GQ Christmas lunch. And I promised Gregor I wouldn't drink. Here we are.
Here we are.
Nothing changes.
No, not at all. Yeah, have some wine, Tracy. So let's talk about...
Was he boring without me? Yes. Lady with the grey silver hair, very attractive, Gregor, in the second row.
Very, very good. Shall we start?
Okay, are you settled? Start. Okay.
Okay. Well, Tracy, as we discussed, I sort of thought it'd be good for you to talk about how you were before the shop. And I wanted you to talk a little, if you could, about what it was like being at the Royal College of Art in around 1989 or thereabouts.
It's actually quite... I left the Royal College of Art in 1989. I left the Royal College of Art in 1989. I went there in 1987.
Yeah.
And 1987, who was born here in 1987? There you go, Gregor.
That's half the audience.
That answers half the question. It was the height of Thatcherism. It was an impossible time. If you didn't... I'm going to put my drink down for this, for God's sake. Maybe Christmas. But if you didn't have money, there was no way to live. There was mass unemployment. You couldn't get a job as a waitress. You couldn't get a job doing anything. It was impossible. And the only way you could live, if you were clever, is probably being a drug dealer, prostitute, I don't know. Uneducated, it was the worst time to be in Britain, probably, thanks to Margaret Thatcher. And people say, why do I hate Thatcher? Because it was the, for me, it was the worst time of my life. Really, really terrible. And it's not like that, you know that thing, like the YBAs, what they say about the YBAs? Oh, we all got on our bike and made our own way. That's not true. We had no other choice. And there was something fantastic that happened in the 70s, Gregor, which was education.
Yeah.
And a lot of women, there was a lot of like kind of feminist women who were teaching in schools during the 70s that told people like me, just do what you want to do, and I have done.
Tell me about some of the people you met at the Royal College of Art. And we were talking recently about this one chap called Alan Miller, who I know is someone who encouraged you to make art.
Well, Alan Miller was one of my tutors. And I won an award at the Royal College of Art, a travel award. And it meant I could travel wherever I wanted. And I won about, I know, it was quite a lot of money, about £4,000. And this was in 1987 or something, 1988 or 1987. I won this award to go travelling wherever I wanted. And I went, oh, great, I'll go straight back to Turkey, you know, do whatever I want to do. And they said the only condition with the ward, that was that I wasn't allowed to leave the college. And they would provide every stretcher, every canvas, every bit of paint I wanted. And before I could accept the award, I had to make the stretchers, I had to make the canvases, I had to do this thing. God, it was horrific. And Alan Miller, he taught me, and there was a technician, Alan Miller, who was my tutor, and the technician, and they taught me how to stretch the canvases, do everything, prime them, everything. And I had all these prime canvases in my studio, and then I was left all summer to paint them with as much paint as I wanted. Well, does that sound like a gift to you, Gregor?
Sounds pretty good.
You're a painter, he's a painter.
Yeah. Maybe not as successful as...
No, but I was never a successful painter. And the point is, if I didn't paint those canvases, I would never have got through the Royal College of Art. I would have failed. And the brilliant thing is that Alan Miller, he came in during the summer about every week or every 5 days or 6 days. He went, this is wrong. Do you know how to mix this colour up, stretch it like this, do it like that? And then one day he walked in and went, yes, you've done it. And I made an actual oil painting, a giant oil painting. And that sounds like nothing to anyone who paints in oils, but I'm telling you, it's really difficult to paint in oils. It's really difficult to make an oil painting that works. And he said, you've done it.
What did it, when you left college, I mean, you spoke there a little bit about how there wasn't a future out there, but at the same time, what did you make of, say, for instance, the buzz or hype or whatever, or the emerging goldsmiths artists at that time were creating?
Well, when I was during my Alan Miller phase, who's my tutor during the summer, who was my summer tutor, which is really rare. So at the Royal College of Art, I had all the paints, all the canvas, and I had a summer tutor, which is fantastic. It's like being given, like it's been like learning a language, and someone comes in every day to you. It's the most beautiful thing. And I was so lucky to have this tutor teaching me how to paint and telling me what to do. I was very lucky. At the same time, we had all the, I used to call them the German boys. There was Marcus Eisenman and Thomas and all these different people. And they were like these real minimal artists. And they really loved what was happening in the Goldsmith School of Art. The Goldsmith School of Art is very good, Tracy, you know. And the reason why they used to take the piss out of me all the time. And one day I came down the stairs and I walked into my student and they all suddenly going, yeah, it's very good. Her words are very excellent. And I said, fuck off out of my studio. Don't take the piss out of me. And they said, no, we like your work. And this was this group of boys at the Royal College of Art that were looking at goldsmiths. always looking at Goldsmiths, saying we should have gone to Goldsmiths. We should have gone there. So I knew about Goldsmiths, and then I found about Goldsmiths because, Gregor, because you didn't go to Goldsmiths either, did you?
No.
He's a great painter, by the way. But we're not bitter, are we?
Not in the least. But how did you find out about Goldsmiths?
What? Because I was pregnant, and my abortion hadn't worked, and I was laying in bed, and my friend Gail came round and said, my boyfriend at the time had gone off to this Goldsmiths thing that was happening. Actually, it was Carl Friedman's thing. Mm. Carl Friedman, Freddy Froglet. Carl Friedman, Counter Editions, fantastic. Okay, Carl Friedman, who has Carl Friedman Gallery, was doing an exhibition with Damien Hirst at, what was it called?
This is in Bermondsey, Building
One, massive exhibition. And I just had an abortion, I was laying in bed, and the abortion hadn't worked, and I was swelling like a massive kind of like big, like yellow piece of pus. And my friend Gail came and said, oh, I've come because I'm going to go to this thing that's happening. There's this really great thing happening, apparently. And I went, oh. And she said, oh, God, you've got to get to hospital. Meanwhile, all these other people at Goldsmiths were doing one thing, and I was doing another, but I knew about it.
Where did you first meet Sarah? How did you meet her?
Okay, this is hardcore again, going back to being pregnant. I was about 2 months pregnant. It was just before Valentine's Day, and Sarah Lucas was having a show at City Racing, which was an old betting shop, which was a squat, which had legal rights to stay there. This is back in 1992. And Sarah was having this show, and Paul Noble.
Noble, yeah.
Paul Noble. So City Racing was this amazing gallery, which was run by a squat, which is run by five artists. John Burgess, Keith Coventry, Paul Noble, and...
I think you did well.
Oh, one other person. I feel guilty not remembering it. But there was five of them, and they run this gallery, and they run it as a squat, and they got legal money, and they got money from the Arts Council to run it, and they decided on shows. And this was Paul Noble's choice of show, which was Sarah Lucas. And Paul Noble said, come, you'll really like this show.
And it was called Penis Nailed to a Board.
Yeah.
That exhibition. And how old were you at this point, roughly, when you were meeting Sarah?
I was 28.
Right. And how might you describe Sarah at this point? How did she come across to you?
Well, I always said to people, I looked at... And also, at this time, as you most probably feel, no one wanted to be friends with me. I didn't have any friends in London. I knew the people I was at the Royal College with who had all gone back to their home counties or doing whatever they were doing. And I was left in my... Yeah, I was left on my own and very much alone. And I didn't actually have many female friends in London because there wasn't that many people I'd got on with or knew. And I said, who's Sarah Lucas? And they said, she's there. And as I turned around like this, there was this woman drinking like a can of Tennent's Extra. Going, oh, yeah, fuck yeah. And all I could see was this amazing smile. She had the most beautiful smile. Her whole face, half her face was taken up by a smile of like absolute jubilation and happiness. And she was fantastic. I went, God, that's Sarah Lucas. And I, at the same time, I was looking to, I always call it cock soup. She'd made this horrible, you know those horrible adverts for soup that are bright orange? You know, like, have some soup today that's, like, bright orange and disgusting. And then she'd put, like, all these, like, penis ends in it. Like, and I always called it knob soup, but it was never called that. And I just... And as I stood there looking, thinking, my God, it's just, like, photographs stuck out with bits of cardboard stuck onto a photograph. I had people going, oh, God, it's so sad. Sarah, she must get a computer. And as people said that, I thought, she's my kind of woman. And I said, who's Sarah Lucas? And as I turned around, she went, you've got really big tits. And I was pregnant, and my tits were, like, out here. And Sarah just went, I like you, you're great, and everything. And we just become friends.
Did, Did you? So how did the idea of the shop come about? I mean, the two of you drunk in a pub?
No. Never ever. You know, that's
chess?
Not true. No, not playing chess. No. What do you think it was, Gregor?
I don't know. Maybe something to do with boyfriends or something like that. I don't know.
Don't you know?
No, you have to remind me.
Brilliant. He really doesn't know. Sarah, I've got a big smile on my face. So Sarah really liked me. And at the time, Sarah thought I was like a creative, interesting person. Sarah was on this amazing high. Saatchi bought her work, which was unexpected because she was making things out of bits of glue and jam and God knows what, hamburgers and bits of crap. At that time, Saatchi had been buying work out of like polished steel, chrome, big, you know, perspex. And Sarah was making work out of bits of like tiny little things. And it was like complete antithesis of anyone would expect Charles Saatchi to buy. And that's quite exciting. And that's a good move for Charles Saatchi as well. He looked at a woman who had a really good idea, which was excellent. And so Sarah and I become friends, and then we walked around. Sarah said to me, I really want you to share a studio with me. And I said, I don't want to make art anymore. I want to be a writer. She said, please help me find a studio. And I said, yes. We walked around the East End, and she said, oh, look, there's a shop there. And I said, it'd be great to get a shop. And she said, a shop? And I said, yeah, a real shop. A shop shop. She said, yeah, a shop. There you go.
It's useful.
Excuse
to...
Excuse me, am I funny? He's really funny, by the way.
Describe, if you could, though, given that it's changed so much, what the East End at that point looked like, particularly the area where the shop ended up.
Well, me and Sarah's first meeting for the shop was at the Sun pub in Brick Lane. Sarah said, I'm meeting the Sun. So I went into the Sun, but I'm always late. So I was like about 35 minutes late, and Sarah was sitting on a stool in the Sun. You're laughing, you don't know what the Sun's like. Sun is now all boarded up. Sarah's sitting there in the Sun like this going, yeah, I have another one. Yeah, all right, fiver. I'm thinking like this. I'm exaggerating Sarah's attitude. But basically Sarah said, where the fuck have you been? Like, it's so late. She said, have you seen where we are? I went, yeah, we're in the Sun. She went, look. And I was going, and at that time I've had an eye operation and I used to be so short-sighted. I got my glasses out of my bag and put them on. I went, my God, she's wearing new clothes, you know. And we were in like the worst kind of bordello kind of strip club in Brick Lane at that time. And Sarah said, what should we do? I said, we just sit here. We just sit here and we have a drink and we decide what, then we leave. Then we leave. And so I said, if we get a studio around here, this is going to be the pub, so we're going to be... I said, yes, you're right. We should stay here and have another drink. Anyway, we stayed there for a couple of hours, and then we left. And then we walked up Brick Lane, and then we found the most perfect building.
And tell me, what kind of building was it? I mean, it's completely dilapidated. If I understand, it was an old dentist, which I find
No, it wasn't dilapidated. It was an old dentist. It was a really lovely Jewish man owned it who lived in Israel, who wanted really lovely people to have it. And he gave this kind of thing to these... It was a estate agent called Land. And Land almost had the right to... Like, I mean, I think this lovely man would have just given it to me and Sarah. It was so cool. Mm. They gave us the rent. The rent was quite high, but also he wanted to sell us the building for the same amount of money percent for rent, which was amazing. If anyone knows about property, that was incredible at the time. And me and Sarah just said, nah, we've done our 6 months, we're out of here. But we should have bought it, really. But it was fantastic. We had the most fantastic landlord, but it was haunted, but it was amazing.
It was haunted?
Yeah, of course it was. You know it was. You were there. Yep. He spent more time... He was in love with me. Gregor, will you explain to the audience why you were in love with me?
I couldn't possibly put it into words. When you signed the lease, even at that moment, you were photographing each other, and even the signing of the lease became a sort of the beginning of the project, I suspect. But
yeah, but also everyone thought me and Sarah were lesbians, including Gregor, right? I thought Gregor was gay. Gregor thought me and Sarah were lesbians. Me and Gregor never got together, but here we are now. Yeah. And No, the most amazing thing is that me and Sarah signed a lease together as women doing this thing, this project. And everyone used to say to me and Sarah, oh, it's a bit of a slant on it. And me and Sarah used to go, yeah. And they go, oh, you're smiling on the slant. And me and Sarah, both of us always, my mouth goes up, but Sarah's whole face goes like that. And people say, and all the journalists or anyone that asked us thought there was like a gimmick or something. But you know, we just had a shop. We were shopkeepers.
And what were the first few days of the shop like? I mean, it was empty, right? I mean,
no, it was pretty hard work. We're painting the walls magnolia against white at the time. Anyone who knows about art in the 90s, white, you know, that bright white colour everywhere. Me and Sarah were opposed. We were opposed. We decided magnolia was good.
And did you divide the rooms up at this point? Because each room had a sort of name, or can you describe, take us through the building?
It was quite tricky, Gregor. Can you take me through the building?
Yes. Okay. In the basement was what I believe you refer to as the think tank.
Yes, the think tank.
Which was a particularly bleak basement in which one could only just become depressed and think.
No, but it wasn't depressing, because that was also our drawing room.
Yes.
Where we'd have our drawing classes. Once a month, me and Sarah would run drawing classes. In the shop window, it would be free drawing classes, come along. Actually, it wasn't free. You had to bring something ridiculous. Like, you had to bring, like, a Beatles tape, or you had to bring some music, or you had to bring whatever the subject, or you had to bring a philosophical idea along. Yeah. Nothing was free. And Angus Fairhurst was the doctor, wasn't he? He had to take charge, being the doctor, in case anyone freaked out or anything, yeah.
Well, I run ahead a bit, but I remember you started to take over the pub next door, the Dolphin.
No, because the drawing classes got so big, we had to take over the pub next door, yeah.
And I remember going to one of your drawing classes, and it was the question is there such a thing as genius? And we all sat around drinking 50 pence pints of Guinness,
and
scratching our heads.
And then me and Sarah nearly had a fight with everyone. Yeah. Because the end of the answer was, me and Sarah's think tank drawing class was, this is after about five drawing classes, was, is there such a thing as genius? And all our friends that turned up were male, said, yes, they are, and we are. And the idea was that male is genius and female isn't. And me and Sarah got very aggressive that night, didn't we?
You did. But also upstairs you had what was called the detective office, I think, which...
It wasn't really... there was the bird...
Yeah.
Birdhouse, and next to it was the... Yes, the detective room.
And this was a room with a lone typewriter on the desk. And I remember at that point you were saying that you would like to write in this environment.
But I did write. Can you hear me? Yeah, I did write in that environment. I did.
Yeah. I mean, at this time, I remember you saying you saw yourself as a writer of sorts.
Are you trying to talk to me about being a writer?
I'm trying to talk to you about being a writer. But you did... The amount of writing you were doing at that time, you were always writing in notebooks, and you wanted to... constantly learn how to use a typewriter, I remember.
I used to be sitting upstairs in this room. So on Saturday nights, which you haven't explained about the opening times, have you?
I did before you came.
All right, okay.
When
sorry.
I was being interesting.
I was partying, sorry, call me boring. okay, so you know the shop was open on Saturday nights all night long, which was really, I mean, fantastic, because those were the days where there were no clubs. You know, unless you were a member of a posh club, you couldn't go anywhere drinking after 11, and there wasn't a party that was regular. Me and Sarah sometimes used to hide behind the counter and go, oh, no, it's Kerif. Like, oh, God, we'd better let him in. We'd let him in, you know, or whatever. There's always loads of artists coming, but...
And was the shop an alternative to a studio then?
It was never a studio to me.
Yeah.
I think it was for Sarah...
Yeah.
For Sarah, it was a move on from everything. But for me, it wasn't. For me, it was just like... I don't know. It was just me trying to... No, it was a good move for me, but not a studio.
I mean, it seemed to evolve over time. I mean, it started, I remember, with the counter and a few objects. And then all the ideas... I don't know how many of those ideas came from
people coming in. Can I tell a brilliant story about Gregor, which will get him in lots of trouble? Gregor used to be in love with me, so Gregor would come to the shop almost every single day to try and buy something. And Gregor's girlfriend lived about, like, half a mile away, so Gregor would walk up to the shop every day, even if we weren't open, just come around. And the, how we met him was he was doing an interview. He interviewed us for Freeze.
Yes.
And that's how we met him. And I called him Gregor Muir, and Sarah said, called him Greg Orr. He just dropped the Muir kind of thing. Anyway, Gregor came... When Gregor found out that I wasn't a lesbian, he actually turned up with half a bottle... This is the days when Gregor was... We were all on the dole and everything. Half a bottle of vodka was a lot of money. Gregor dropped the half a bottle of vodka and said, "You're not a lesbian." I said, "No." He said, "Do you want the vodka?" I said, "Yeah, all right." He said, "Let's go upstairs now and make love."
Okay, so... That's...
No, okay, this is true. And I said, "But you're gay." And he said... Anyway, can I say, like, 17, 16 years later, we're really, really good friends. And Gregor was there right at the beginning. So everything he says now, everything he says, don't believe a fucking word of it.
Can we talk about some of the items in the shop, Tracy? Whose
idea was it to make the T-shirts?
Me and Sarah's.
And...
But also some of the more bizarre things in there, apart from Gary.
Gary Hume. Sarah made Gary Hume, I think. She created that whole sculpture of Gary. No, Rose Bush. OK, let's go back. That's what we're going to say. Rose Bush. There's a great story about Gregor. So that's what I'm going back to. So Gregor's girlfriend lived down the road in this, what we thought was a really nice council flat at the time. To us, it was posh. Anyway, so Gregor said, "Oh, God, I'm in such bad trouble. I've got to buy a rose bush. We're going to this... Was it wedding?
Yeah, I was going for
birthday wedding,
a posh dinner.
Posh dinner, wedding, whatever it was. And he had to buy this rose bush. And he'd been given £15 to go to Columbia Road to buy a rose bush. So what he'd said to his girlfriend, "OK, I'm going to go now really early," which was actually Saturday morning about 4 o'clock, to get to Columbia Road to buy a rose bush, which meant he was coming to me in Sarah's shop because we were open all night Saturday. And Gregor walked in, "Oh, baby, Gregor," everything. And then Gregor had his half bottle of vodka. We had our little bits of drink. And people used to just bring drinks to the shop and everything. And we all got pissed and everything. And at 11 o'clock in the morning, Gregor said, "If I don't get to Columbia Road, I'm in so much trouble. I'm in lots of trouble." And Sarah said, "Oh, don't worry about it. I'll make you a rose bush." And I'm saying that like an Australian way, but she did. Sarah then cut out the letters rosebush, put them all onto bits of wire, stuck them into a bit of like foam in a vase, and said to him, "Here's your rose bush."
She said, "You can have that for a tenner."
And she said, "Yeah." And would have left Gregor £15. Gregor said, "Oh, girlfriend won't take it. She won't take it. I'll be in so much trouble. I can't." And Gregor said, "I really want it. I really want it for myself. I can't. I don't know what to do." Anyway, he left it.
Yeah.
Got in loads of trouble, everything. You're getting more trouble now, weren't you, for me telling this story? Anyway, got in more trouble. But then guess what? Where did you see the rose bush next?
It was in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Thanks for reminding me.
Next question, Gregor.
Well, I did at this point just want you to talk a little bit about...
Doesn't this look chic, though? Yeah, forgot that. I'm trying to turn it because I'm saying, what the hell is that?
That's a bad morning, I think.
That's by Ken.
Yeah, can you tell us about Ken, the fish pond?
Okay, so I said to Sarah, if we do the shop... Because Sarah said, "You're a lunatic, but I really like you." And Sarah just kind of needed me for ideas, and that was our agreement. I had the ideas, Sarah had the energy, and Sarah made the art, but I had the ideas. Or Sarah had ideas too. But the point is, the shop was equal together, and the rule was we got there at 11 in the morning. And I always was 20 or 15 minutes late. And Sarah, I wanted to have a pet. I wanted to have a cat. And Sarah said no, but she allowed me to have goldfish. And our pond called Ken was called Ken, and every fish in the pond was called Ken. And we had Ken Livingstone, Ken Kiff, who's one of my favourite art tutors, and one of my favourite Gary Hume's art tutors, Ken Kiff. And we had every Ken, but our favourite Ken fish were Ken Kiff and Ken Livingstone. So our fish were called Ken, basically. Yeah. And when people come into the shop, if they didn't have enough money to buy anything, which prices went from 50p to £500, approximately, didn't they? And if they didn't have money to buy anything, they could just give 2p or 10p to Ken. And this is when it got really sad. Me and Sarah would get really pissed. And the pub next door put Guinness down to 50p a pint. And me and Sarah would go back and we'd steal the money from Ken. And then we'd have to write, I owe you, Ken, 36p. And then we'd have to go to the pub and go, look, we're... And then we'd have to write, oh, I owe the pub, like, you know, 40... not 44p, but 24p or whatever, and it was difficult. But the fish pond was all money, which everyone throw in and make wishes, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, it was a shop in which you bought things, and you would go in and there'd be Sarah or Tracy behind the counter, and if there wasn't anything that you particularly liked to buy there and then, there might be a discussion about making something that you did. But I remember at the same time there was certain big sellers, which were things like the Rothko blankets.
Well, big sellers, £2.50, yeah. Gregor.
Exactly. Hearst ashtrays, they were...
Oh, the Damien Hearst ashtrays went up to 15 quid. Go on, carry on.
Hockney badges.
Al David, you know, went up to £5 at one point, yeah. Go on, carry on, Gregor. £5 in 1993 was a lot of money if you were on the dole. And I've got to say, there was lots of people who were students, dole people, and also most people. Who here is under 25? You don't know what the dole means. Being on the dole was meant that we didn't earn a living, but we could do whatever we wanted to do. And if it wasn't for the dole, me and Gregor wouldn't be sitting here. It meant that we could do what. Now, if you're unemployed and you're really intelligent, you have to go every day and explain that to them. And if you're really intelligent, you probably end up committing suicide rather than do that. You know, we were very lucky then in lots of ways.
Mm. It was unusual. A friend of mine described the doll once as the big artist
in fact,
the sky.
A couple of our friends did commit suicide, actually, at that time, didn't they?
They did, indeed. You started to call yourself the Birds at one point, or how? What was...
Me and Sarah, the Birds, yes. Me and Sarah decided... The shop was getting popular. We're having at least like 10 people a week coming. And people going, oh, that shop, what's it called, that shop? We've got to have a name for the shop. So we would always listen to... Did anyone listen to Steely Dan tonight?
Yeah. For quite a while.
OK, so me and Sarah would go shopping at Brick Lane Market. We bought two CDs. We bought a David Bowie CD and a Steely Dan CD. Our Steely Dan CD, we got lots of titles for work from the shop. One of the greatest titles was The Aubergine Is Falling, which was an aubergine on the counter with a little flag, which was a toothpick with a little piece of sticky tape that says, is falling. People come in and went, what's that about? We said, music we listen to all the time. They said, don't get you. We're going to Steely Dan. It's so funny, The Aubergine Is Falling. Me and Sarah have been listening to a Steely Dan tape for 6 months, believing we heard the words, the aubergine is falling. You still don't get it, do you? It was the old regime is falling. And also, so we was going to call the shop, the aubergine is falling, okay? Like our wombs are falling out of us, we are women, you know, but we've got to work and everything. But the other idea was, what was it called? Do you remember this?
Four.
No, the Golden Years.
For David Bowie?
Yeah, David Bowie, Golden Years. Yeah. Me and Sarah stayed up all night till about 4 o'clock in the morning. We found all this yellow plastic. In Brick Lane in those days, or around that area of London, you could find, like, you know, 20 metres of yellow plastic, 40 metres of, like, red carpet. You could find loads of all kinds of different materials where all warehouses just had to leave and they just throw everything on the street. Me and Sarah found all this yellow plastic. Looks a bit like piss or yellow glass or whatever. Oh, and we went, oh, brilliant, fine. We dragged it back, you know, like kind of, oh, we'll get it back to our nest and everything, which was the shop. And we went, oh, I was going, like, it looks golden. And we're listening to our tape, Golden Years, was going, golden years. Because we had the one tape that kept going round and round and round. Anyway, and then, Golden Years, brilliant. We cut all the letters out, Golden Years. And me and Sarah on a ladder, and we were 3 o'clock in the morning. We almost got Golden Years up. I went, oh, Sarah, I'm so tired. And she said, yeah, I'm really tired. Because we used to stay up, we worked so hard. Anyway, let's put them up tomorrow. I said, let's put them up tomorrow morning in the morning. You know, when it's bright and blue and everything. We came in the morning, Sarah went, fucking hell, thank God we didn't do that. Golden years for a shop. But it would make sense now, wouldn't it?
But yeah. But what do you... Tell me more about the local community. There were some interesting characters I remember meeting in the shop who were just local people. I mean, was it popular with locals?
It was really popular because people would come in and school teachers would come in or like the guy, he's died recently, this really nice guy, he actually ran most of Brick Lane Market. He tried to get me and Sarah to do T-shirts and decorate a car and do stuff. I mean, it was really popular. And also, me and Sarah were very supported and protected as well. And it was quite dodgy then. In 1993, two women having a shop that was open on Saturday night and we weren't prostitutes. And one night the police came in, which was brilliant. The police came in, the art police, they came in. And me and Sarah went, you look like policemen. I said, they are police. They're police, you know. They came in and said, so what are you exactly doing here? We said, well, we've got a shop, you know, it's a shop. And they said, what are you selling? T-shirts, badges, everything. I said, what's this T-shirt say? And it was, have you wanked over me yet? And he said, you know, this could be a criminal offence. And I said, yeah, but you haven't, have you? So it's not. Anyway, so, and it was this amazing thing. We walked around the shop. I say the shop was beautiful, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm getting sentimental now. It was so funny, because me and Sarah would make everything. Each week, everything was new for anyone who came there, and it was funny. This is 1993, a long time ago. But these policemen, they had such a nice time walking around, and then they gave us our card. They said, if you're ever in trouble, you call this number. Because they knew we weren't prostitutes. We had we didn't have a criminal record, and we were artists, and we were so protected. It was a nice thing. And also some people in cafes and different things were very looked out for me and Sarah. And they liked it that we were there, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, it was an abandoned, sort of rough neighbourhood, for sure. I mean, that was going to be one of my questions. What was it like to be two women working there in the shop window, people passing all the time?
Me and Sarah go, it's 11 o'clock, let's put the shutters up. And we had these kind of grills which we'd put up and we'd put them up at the windows. But, you know, me and Sarah were just open and it said, shop open. Have you wanked over me yet? I'm so fucky. Fuck off, you ass. Yeah, whatever, I don't know. Or get a leader. That was our other thing. When the East End of London had this whole racist thing, we had this thing, your country needs a leader. And we put that in the window. At the same time as, bring me the head of Tracy Emin on a pillow. And then people could come in. I go, yeah, I'm Tracy Emin. What are you going to do about it? And it was brilliant. We had this political people coming in, social people, school kids. It was so... No children, actually. But school teachers. It was so... No children ever come in our shop. It was too scary, yeah. Mum's and dad said, never go into that shop, yeah. But it was brilliant because it made... And we didn't get any public funding for it. Sarah paid for it. And actually, Charles Saatchi bought Sarah's work. And Sarah just took Charles Saatchi's money and put it into the shop. And then kind of not employed me, but got me along as her sidekick, who I was perfect for. And we did this amazing project.
I mean, it was getting more and more people. The reputation of the shop was going around London. It was becoming very, very popular.
Yeah, we had at least 10 people a day coming, yeah.
I think I remember the weekend parties or opening.
Yeah, no, they were big, yeah.
Being packed. And, but my question is at this point, I mean, did you get any visitors from art institutions such as Tate?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
We did. We had lots of visitors from museums, Tate, everything. Well, Sarah got a show at Museum of Modern Art because they came there. And we had people like Sadie Coles come, Anthony Doffey, Lorcan O'Neill, all the Doffey people come, Jay Joplin. That's how Jay met me through the shop.
It's how a lot of people met each other as well, I think it's fair to say. But I mean,
but me and you didn't meet each other like that.
No, we'll come back to that. But who were, I mean, regular visitors would have included also people who maybe are slightly, or maybe not remembered at the moment, I don't know.
Serious art critics who then might have been 40 and now are 55, or then might have been 55 and now 70. This is 16, 17 years ago. And these people might have just been like, you know, out for the night and thinking it's very funny. And, you know, they were there.
I mean, tell us about, say, for instance, there were artists locally, and there was also this unusual chap, Joshua Compston, who was probably a regular visitor, I think it's fair to say. But he must have got a lot from it, I always thought.
Yeah, but Joshua's in love with me too, Gregor.
Oh, damn.
No, Joshua's our great friend, and Joshua couldn't believe his luck that these two older women... Joshua was like, oh, no, Joshua's... How old was he? 20?
About 24, 25.
No, at that time he was 20. Yeah.
Really?
When me and Sarah opened the shop, he was 19 or 20. He says, John, you inspire me, you women, you inspire me. You'd come to the shop, you inspire me, you inspire me. He was very 18th century, puffed up, his blonde albino hair and everything. He was really amazing. And he started off Fate Worse Than Death. Does anyone know about the Fate Worse Than Death? Not the... So, but you know about the faints that we had? No.
By the way, Joshua Compton used to run a gallery on Rivington Street called Factual Nonsense. And, yeah, that's one of his projects. He was very, very young, excitable. He'd always remind me of the British Empire somehow. And he would stage events such as a fate, F-E-T-E, worse than death. And that would involve, say, 50 artists with stalls running around Shoreditch. In a concentration which were very, very left field.
And also, this is an area on a Saturday which would be completely, like, no traffic, nothing, because it was still related to the city. So it was a really strange time in the early 90s, and that's what Griggle's trying to explain, about how different it was then to how it is now. Hoxton or Shoreditch or Spitalfields now... It seems really trendy and amazing. But on a Saturday afternoon in 1993, it would have been completely empty, like a ghost town, tumbleweed blowing.
And did you get press coverage for the shop at the time?
Yes, we did. We got Greg Old's Review in Freeze magazine, and we got Pauline Daly's Fans magazine that she did, and that was it, I think.
But tell me about also the parties at the shop, because there would be occasions, for instance, where you would celebrate your birthday at the shop.
There was only one celebration of birthday, and that was the end of the shop, which was called Fucking Fantastic, Do Whatever She Wants to Do.
At 30.
30, party when she likes kind of thing. And no one knew whether it was me or Sarah who were 30. And we had this amazing party, and we had Joshua Compston, who was an amazing maverick. I said, Joshua, can you get us any drink? And he said, I know there's people who do Zeiss beer. And Zeiss beer was like half cider, half champagne, or something really weird. Like, basically, you have two of them, you're off your fucking face. And from Essex, and these girls come with blonde hair. They're amazing. They said, we can only work from 7 o'clock till 11, and then we leave. And then, meanwhile, me and Sarah were still in the pub next door at the Dolphin, which we haven't talked about, the Dolphin at 11. And I ran back, and these girls were behind the counter, me and Sarah's shop counter, wearing their Zeiss bit, their blonde hair, everything. Said, we're really happy. The people here are really nice. We're serving drinks. And you've made £2 on those badges. You've made £8 on the thing. You've got a Gary Hume T-shirt that says this, and you've got this and that and everything. I went, oh, wow, fantastic. I said, we should be happy for another hour. They said, can we invite our boyfriends? I said, yeah. And they called their boyfriends, and it was brilliant. Me and Sarah were at the party in the shop, the end of the shop, where me and Sarah want to go out like rock stars. The whole shop gets smashed up, everything gets stolen. But no, the Zeiss girls were there, collecting all the money, putting my little nose in. It was brilliant.
And Gilbert and George, I remember, turned up.
And also, people turned up to the party. Me and Sarah sent loads of people. Imagine meeting Tracy Evans, Sarah Lucas, and we were nobodies, you know, absolutely nothing. And then you see these beautiful blonde girls looking like beauty queens serving the room. And it was not intentional. Everything, I swear to God, everything me and Sarah did, and you know this, was not intentional. I was broke. Sarah said, we've got to do something. You've got to change something. We've got to do something. Maybe Sarah had the spark behind it, but I was a lot of energy behind it. And it was fantastic 6 months of our life. We were open from... we're closed Mondays, open Tuesday from 11 till 6 till Friday, and then Saturday night from 11 o'clock at night right through to Sunday afternoon. And I don't know many people who work that hard, and we work really hard.
And I remember you, but also Sarah, saying very much that it sort of, in her way, resolved the problem of sitting in a studio cold and bored. And that it would be, in some ways, a way to kind of pull all these ideas, all this energy and activity would be in itself a kind of way out of that trap. And it did seem to bring together a large swathe, well, of the art world in London, certainly met each other at the shop, I think, because you would just have to hang out there. I mean, there wasn't a programme or
anything. Well, Carl fell in love with me.
Yes.
This is important.
Let's talk about that. That's Carl Friedman.
Yes.
And... that's what, you ended up in a relationship with him by the end of it, so it was all good news.
Yeah, it was good. And Sarah was with Angus, and I was with Carl, and you would know what...
Yeah. Just before we... but just tell us really briefly, at the beginning, not very much stuff, but by the end of it, you'd accumulated so much stuff. I remember boxes, and I think I came to visit you round about the very end of the shop, where everything is... lying around.
I was crying.
Yeah, you were a bit upset about something with Carl or something. But anyway, at that point, I remember thinking, what are they going to do with all this stuff? But what happened to it?
What
happened
to it?
You burnt it.
Because Sarah made me custodian of the shop, and I become custodian. And being custodian, I had to protect the shop forever. And this is what's so lovely about everyone here. I can't believe that you're all here so interested in the shop. The shop was a 6 month art project that we did, but it was amazing for us as friends to unite. It was like after art school, we still believe in art, and we'd meet and we'd talk about art. We'd have a place and we'd discuss and we'd argue about art, wouldn't we? We had a place, and me and Sarah made this place where people could come after art school, and this was in the early 90s when it wasn't nightclubs. We didn't have money. We didn't have anywhere to go. Pubs closed at 10:30 on a Sunday, 11 o'clock on a Saturday. There was nowhere for us to go. We couldn't go to posh restaurants because we didn't have the food. But me and Sarah created this amazing place where people who loved art could come and just talk, and that's what it was about, and that's what was really, really important.
What was the last day of the shop like when you handed the keys back? Was that a sad day for the enterprise?
No. No, it's the beginning of my life, really.
Yeah.
The shop was amazing.
Okay, we can take a second.
But it's true, Gregor. The shop was amazing.
Yeah.
People who weren't there, you couldn't be there. Only people who were there know what it was like. It was so funny and so amazing and so brilliant. It was like a stepping stone for lots of ideas and lots of different things. And me and Sarah used to have this joke about perspex, too much perspex. In the early 90s, everyone was making art about perspex, and me and Sarah were actually making things every single day, trying to make things. In between not being the greatest artist in the world, we had fantastic conversations with really good people like Gregor, who would come in, Carl Friedman, Kerif, and Angus. I mean, there was a whole gang of us, wasn't there?
There certainly was. What were your plans after the shop? And I remember asking you this question in the original interview that we did way back when, but I think you may have been heading off to an airport.
My first airport. I wanted to meet International Man. I was going to be at Frankfurt, And I was going to stand there, and I was going to make the biggest billboard poster in the world at Frankfurt Airport, and international man would be standing saying, why is she so beautiful? I don't understand. It's not the kind of woman I love. I just... And as he walks back from the billboard like this, he does, I'm sorry. And I go, I'm sorry. He goes, it's you. I love you. I love you. I love you. That was my end of the shop. And Sarah's end of the shop was, I'm going to become a don at Oxford.
She had this incredible idea that she could go to Oxford anyway to become more intelligent.
No, because she was into that TV programme, was it? Morse.
Inspector Morse.
Sarah, And then, I was totally international. I wanted to be international woman and meet international man. And Sarah was just in love with Inspector Morse.
She felt that being just in Oxford, she would become more intelligent naturally.
I'm going to move to... I'm going to go to Oxford. Yeah. So people said, what are you going to do after shop? And I was going to meet international man and Sarah was going to move to Oxford. But what did we do?
Well, in a way, this is where we might show the next batch of images, was you went to Geneva.
Which is kind of a compromise, really. Yeah.
The shop actually had another manifestation when Tracy and Sarah, in August, were invited to go to show at Gallery Analytics,
which is so funny.
It's a bizarre name. And they put on an exhibition called Army to Armani, which is what you'll be seeing here next.
Look at some of these now.
But could you just for now just tell us what was meant by the title, Army to Armani?
Okay, so me and Sarah thought, how can we get some designer clothes? How can we, like, smoke loads of fags and everything? And it was quite tricky, impossible. And also, at the same time, the gorilla girls, you know. Does anyone know who the gorilla women are, gorilla girls? New York, fantastic, amazing, like feminists, brilliant. They've made this poster saying how to get ahead as an artist is to smoke big cigars and wear Armani suits. And I thought, great, let's do that. So it's kind of a postmodern idea on feminism, but I support everything they do. I love what the smoking cigar gorilla girls do. Anyway, I love it. So I said to Sarah, let's make a play on this. Let's do it. I didn't say let's make a play on this. I didn't know words. I said, let's just go to Geneva and do this. And let's do... And then we wanted to have from, like, Yves Saint Laurent to... No rhyming. Let's have, like, Vivienne Westwood, or let's have... And all the fashion design... And the only one we could have was Army to Armani. Let's do it. Me and Sarah turned up in Geneva. We went by train, boat and everything, wearing army boots and army gear, secondhand army gear, smoking Marlboro Light. And we came home, and our plan was to come home smoking Armani suits with big fucking cigars. And we did it. That was our plan.
Can we just roll through these quicker, please? But just, I mean, you could maybe just, if you see anything...
This is called We've Got Long Labia. And this is me and my... That's me and my Armani suit, yeah. This was our think tank. This is Sarah's map of the world from her brain. Sarah's egg tent. God is dad. Nietzsche is dead. Guess which one Sarah wrote. Okay, everyone's got a guess. Guess what one Sarah wrote and guess which one I wrote. Okay, Sarah Lucas, you got...
Nietzsche.
You're wrong. Nietzsche is dead is mine and God is dead is Sarah's. Long labia is mutual. This is my work. And this was a love poem to Carl Freeman. You put your hand around my mouth, but everything continues. Every noise continues. Blah, blah, blah. This is me and Sarah's washing an ode to Byron. This is one of Sarah's penises cans. Isle's got a spider. This is one of the most glamorous portraits I've ever had. This is me and Sarah in Geneva after we become healthy. And can I say a nice thing to Luigi and Barbara Poller, who put us up in Geneva for 6 weeks, me and Sarah would go down into the gallery, we'd go, let's get a bottle of wine.
well, this one tastes okay, I don't like this one, this is okay. We'd be taking bottles of wine out that cost maybe £200 or £103 a bottle of wine, you know, amazing wine, and we'd go off to the supermarket and then replace them with really bad wine. So they've still got garrus. The legacy, yeah, I know. But see how healthy and young we looked, it was amazing. In Geneva. Is that the end?
Well, just a few more questions. I mean, the other, I mean, you then opened the Tracy Emin Museum in Waterloo. I mean,
can we just put one up, that last one, keep it there anyway?
The glamorous one.
Yeah, the glamorous one. Not the long labia, but the other one.
And from the shop then to Geneva and then Tracy Emin Museum in Waterloo, I mean, did you see any connection between your own institution and the shop?
The Waterloo Museum. The Tracy Emin Museum became about because I couldn't afford a studio and I couldn't afford to travel. You know me, I'm a really lazy person. I hate travelling across London. I hate travelling. I'm a very homebody kind of person. That's why I love London and that's why I'm here. I don't like to move. I only can move when I move to know where I'm going. I never hardly ever visit friends' houses or anything. And to me, to have a studio is very difficult to go from. I'm much better working at home or something, but then when I'm at home, I don't work. I just sleep, so it's kind of tricky. Anyway, with the music, the idea of this thing. So there's a place, this shop across the road. It was vacant, and it was like £200 a week or something, and I couldn't afford it as a studio. And then Carl said, "But as a museum, yes." So it became my museum. So I got the Tracy Emin Museum, and it was a follow-on from all those ideas from the shop and everything, which I've always done. I've always done public things. As an artist, I do things. And like my column for The Independent, who read The Independent, my column? Four people. Bloody hell. Well, I might write a column for The Mirror. Who reads The Mirror? Who reads newspapers? What I'm saying is that with the museum, I had to stop doing it because I had like 50 coach loads of Japanese students. Yeah, Tracy Emin Museum, hello. Like that. I was like, oh God, and I go, oh fucking hell, I forgot the Japanese museum. It's just me on my own and everything. And it was brilliant. It was good fun, but I had to stop doing it because I'm not. I was, you know, those cinemas where there's someone who's the ice cream person, the thing person, the person who lets you in. My museum was a bit like that, and I wasn't big enough to do that.
Just a question about the shop in terms of how it could ever happen again. I mean, do you think anything like that could happen?
No,
again?
Because I burnt everything.
Okay.
And the reason why I burnt everything is because the shop could only be there for the people who are really the light. Sarah said to me, she said to me, I can't believe people said they went to the shop. We know who went to the shop because they wrote their names in the book. We know who went to the shop. Maybe there's a couple of people we didn't remember or something, but most people, the shop was a lonely place. It was Saturday night at 2 o'clock in the morning, two women with a shop. I mean, think about that now, how weird that is to have that kind of occupation. Me and Sarah were doing it to make money, to make a living and to talk about art. And we sat there the whole time, 5 days a week, talking about art, discussing everything. And no one does that anymore. And we never got any financial backing for it. We did it all on our own. We did it with Saatchi, buying Sarah's work, paid for the shop. And then Sarah trusted me to be there, because you couldn't do that on your own anyway. And it wasn't just Sarah's idea, it was both our ideas. And not just that, it was a collaboration. Our friends, whether it was Gregor, Kerith, Carl, Angus, Sam, we had lots of different friends who would come, who would constantly be there. It was a good place to hang out. It was funny, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
It was a funny place.
Okay, well, before we should hand over to the audience now, if there's anything else that you feel that's been missed out or if you'd like to say anything else.
No, I want to say something really important. Gregor
was really
okay. And he wore this yellow shirt and he's taken. Did you see a photo of him wearing a yellow shirt any time? That's his time when he was really in love with me.
I actually took those all out. Okay, we should go to the audience. If anyone has any questions at this point, it would be a good moment to ask one. Speechless.
I have a question.
Oh, these ones. Alison Jacks took these photos.
Really?
Who has a gallery now in London. Huh. This one. Yeah. And the earlier photos, Carl Friedman took them. Carl Friedman. In fact, the people who took these photos all have galleries, weirdly enough. They're very clever people.
Can I ask, would you do it again?
Can you at least wait for the mic?
You have to wait for the mic.
Would you do it again?
No, you can't do it again.
No, I mean, would you repeat the exercise?
No, but me and Sarah, there's a suit which says the birds, the shop, and it's our Tippy Edren suit. Did you have a photo of that at all?
I think so, yeah.
There's a suit with a ball of string. And me and Sarah's idea is that when we were about 80 or 90, as I burnt everything, Sarah goes, "Nah, she didn't. We're going to show everything we ever made in the shop." And both of us, we're naked. And I either wear the jacket or she wears the skirt, and we're naked. One way or the other, and it's our private view card, and it says everything, nothing, everything that wasn't burnt from the shop, and we get an airplane hangar in Essex or somewhere, and me and Sarah just work like fucking lunatics. We just make the maddest work. So, yes, we will do it again. Me and Sarah Lucas, when we're 80, we'll probably do the shop again, and I hope you'll come, all of you.
Anyone else? Oh.
Your art and your life were inseparable at that time. Do you think they're separated now?
Yes, they are. My art and my life are separated from then because that's all I had. I had nothing. When I had the shop, I remember cycling. This is like a weird thing. I cycled up Bishopsgate every day for the shop at 11 o'clock, between 5 to 11 and 5 past 11. Every day, except for Saturdays. Saturday, the shop was closed. The day I didn't cycle, the bomb went off. Does anyone remember the bomb going off there? And I lived in Waterloo at the time, and I felt the curtains of my bathroom come back from that bomb. Now, every single day I cycled there. And the next day, on the Monday, I got there and I cycled again. You know, my life is weird. If that bomb had gone off on the Sunday, I'd be dead, but it wouldn't do. We hadn't done whatever it was. What I'm trying to say to you is London was so different then. The IRA would never put a bomb in London now, ever. It's impossible. And those times are so different now from what we live in. It's really a different time. It really is. Everyone's gone quiet now, but it really is different. No, I'm not scared of the IRA. But what I'm saying to you is, you know, I used to cycle there every... Imagine if I'd have died cycling up there. No one would remember me. No one would care about me. I'd just be a little artist that died. No, it's true, what I'm saying. What's your question?
you had lots of voucher schemes and little schemes for raising money to try and subsidise your living. People could buy £10 bonds.
Oh yeah, my bonds. Yeah, the Tracy Emin bonds. Yes.
Were they part of the shop?
No, never part of the shop. Tracy Emin. Yeah, the Tracy Emin bond, Tracy Emin Museum bonds, and also the main thing was to invest in my life, my creative potential. So in 1993, people could invest in my creative potential for £10, but with no cheques, only postal orders or cash. Now, I'll tell you what, when you're on the dole and you owe £6,000, you get 80 quid come from the post 1 week. You feel like a millionaire. It's fantastic. It's tenacity. I'm clever, and everyone should be clever. And all those people, I think I've paid them back. All those people that invested in my creative potential for £10, I think they got a lot better. It's good, I haven't let them down, so. hand.
No. I think it's going up here.
It's going up.
Thanks. Hi, Tracy. If you had to pick one moment, one memory, one instance in this project, which one would it be?
To do with the shop?
Yeah.
Me and Sarah signing the lease on Roman Road with land, it was land estate agents with Jonathan, the estate agent. And it was such a brilliant moment. It was so funny. And there's great photos of me and Sarah signing the lease. And I wasn't part of the lease at all, but it was lovely that I signed it too. And then me and Sarah had this loyalty to that moment. It's a moment of art, which is brilliant. And I can't explain to you, at that time, in 1993, everything was almost impossible, wasn't it, Gregor?
Mm.
And me and Sarah just went off on our own and just did something. It was fantastic. And other people now can do that. And anyone thinks the recession is bad now, please go back to then.
What's there now, where your shop is?
People live there, I think. But Gregor's going to start doing a tour.
Yeah. Even with the people living there.
Do the people know?
Was there a question?
Funny person, yeah. Person at the front. Here. No, here. She's asking earlier.
I feel very important now. Did you make much money from the shop?
Yes.
Did you make a profit?
So much money. So rich, you know. Can't believe it. We sold badges for 50 pence, and we sold, badges, 50 pence, T-shirts, £2.50, then went up to £3, £8, £20, they went up. Last T-shirt we sold was for £150. Sarah's work sold a lot, her posters and everything, and what was amazing with Sarah, which is fantastic, was everything with the shop we'd share. So Sarah would sell a poster for £500 and she shared the money with me, which is amazing, because no one knew who I was. I was just Sarah's sidekick. I was just like a funny person, wasn't I?
Mm.
Yeah. But Sarah said, don't let me down, don't let me down. And I haven't. And Sarah, I love Sarah dearly, and she's a brilliant person, brilliant human being, but she's very private. And Sarah, when I first met Sarah, Sarah was the open, big person, you know, and I wasn't. Mm. And it's strange how our lives are, but Sarah lives in the country, and she loves her life, and she's like the Barbara Hepworth of the art world, you know. Sarah's just trying to make it stand up. I'm trying to make myself stand up, you know.
You said how terrible the 90s were with Thatcher and all the rest. Do you think great suffering produces great art?
No, I don't think great suffering produces anything good. But interesting thing about the 90s was it was the last moments of us having... There was a great thing called the, Enterprise Allowance Scheme. Mm. Which meant you come off the dole, and if you proved that you weren't on the dole, you didn't have to be. I wasn't on the dole for another year. I come off the dole for a year. It's called the Enterprise Allowance Scheme, and I think any government now that goes into power must provide a scheme for people like me who aren't lazy, who don't have to fucking sign on the dole. The dole is humiliating for anyone who works. Lots of people have amazing allotments, have gardens, and they give all their vegetables to everyone, but they have to go fucking sign on every day now and try and prove they've got to do a job. It's not fair. I just think that there must be a better system for people who are creative in this country. Creative and imaginative, that make the world move. I'm on the school curriculum now. School children come up to me, not school kids, but 14-year-olds come up to me in the street and love what I do. They think I'm brilliant. Girls think I'm great. You know, it's important that you've got to be... I'm not talking about role models or anything like that. I drink, I have parties, I'm happy, I work, but I work hard. And I'm an artist, and I can prove it's possible to be a good person, to be an artist. You don't have to just do what everyone tells you you have to do. That's true, isn't it? No, I'm sorry. I disagree with lots of things at the moment, totally in terms of education.
We can show some slides of my paintings now.
Can we see some of Gregor's paintings now? Yeah.
Okay, one more, and then maybe we can wrap it up. Are you?
You produced a range of goods to sell in the shop in a huge range of materials. Do you think that's influenced your range of materials that you use nowadays? Fabrics, paper, anything?
That won't be the last question.
No.
I use lots of materials. I use anything I can use to make art, but I'm not... I can only use what I'm good at. So I want one more question. Good question. Gregor, no, you should ask the last question.
No. This...
He's been desperate.
Yeah.
Yeah, enough of that.
A facetious question. Which spirit were you haunted by?
Oh, yeah.
At the shop.
At the shop.
You said you were haunted.
I think... the doctor. That's the honest truth. But at the moment, you should ask me what I'm haunted by now. That's a better question. My dad. Mm-hmm. There you go. But he's not dead yet.
Okay. I think we'll come back it up.
Gregor, you got to say goodbye though, Gregor.
Goodbye, everyone.
No, Gregor, just have a big, you can't just say goodbye like that.
Okay. Well, no, I mean, if I can't say goodbye like that, it was an incredible period. To do this talk has been really good fun. And we're talking about a whole sort of dynamic of things whereby this particular moment came about, which was very, very special. And in the series of events that maybe even ran up to the opening of this place, Tate Modern, it was always interesting to see the way in which British art in that particular decade did take on quite in its own momentum, and it was a fascinating thing, and it brought about an interest in contemporary art more generally. I think without the shop, my interest in contemporary art could have just evaporated. It was a really useful thing. It reminds me of activities that other artists have put together a little, in terms of just bringing an artistic community into.
Yeah, can I ask a question of the audience? Room. You never went to the shop. But looking at all those images, did it look like fun?
Yes.
Thank you for being here.
Brilliant. Great, thanks.